Chapter 2. High Charity, Chamber of Decision, 850 BCE, The Age of Reconciliation. Our assassin has failed. We suspect our spy was caught and executed. And it seems that Usa Zelis lives. McKen, the prophet of inner conviction, could not discern if the Sangheili commander had an apologetic tone in his voice, the translation being maddeningly indeterminate at times, but his body language seemed to suggest it. He stood there with his long, split-jawed head bowed. "So where is he, then?" McKen said, and Kurlom beside him grunted acknowledgement. Commander Vio Griot shifted his metal-sheathed boots, which clanked softly on the deck as if to proclaim his discomfort. "We have confirmed only that Usa Zelis has departed Sangheilios. A handful of his adherents, just 6, lost heart and remained behind. They'd planned to follow him, but lost their nerve. They watched the ships depart and insisted that Usa's intention of leaving the planet was clear. These disheartened ones came crawling to us, full of remorse, which will, of course, do the traitors no good. It's surprising that Usa allowed them to stay behind alive," Kurlom rumbled thoughtfully as he tapped the arm of his anti-grav chair to produce a pungent tea. He inhaled the fragrant steam before sipping it. At Kurlom's age, his use of traditional medicines was intensive. "Perhaps not so surprising," Vio remarked. "Usa is unusual and paradoxical. On the one hand, he can be merciful, more than we are accustomed to. On the other, he insists on the traditional ethos. Strength is character, as we say. And, of course..." He seemed to hesitate, perhaps not wanting to be impolitic. "Yes," McKen prompted. "And, of course... never surrender." Vio looked away, jaws spread grimacingly wide. McKen was mildly amused. The San Shyum, and the writ of union itself, politely insisted that the Sangheili hadn't surrendered. They had instead joyfully chosen to throw in their lot with the San Shyum, had wisely chosen to set out on the path that led to the great journey. They had experienced a species-wide spiritual epiphany, realizing that the prophets of the San Shyum were correct all along. But McKen knew that many Sangheili nursed a secret shame, the unspoken belief that it had been surrender after all. Kurlom slurped down the last of his tea, then asked, "So those who stayed behind were clear on Usa's intention. What determines their clarity? What is his intention?" "They claim he has found a world on which are many forerunner relics. An uncharted world, Minister. Only he, his mate, and his second-in-command know of its whereabouts, or anything more of its nature." "And no one else knows where this world lies?" McKen asked. "I find that preposterous." "Yet it would seem that way. So far, no one else," Griot confirmed. "Nor do we know what course they plotted. This was kept a secret. Usa must have surmised that his clans were infiltrated."
"They entered slipspace. And after that?"
"They seem to have changed course many times, and we were not able to trace them. Still, we must continue to search," Kurlom said. "This Usa Zelis is a vile and perfidious heretic. He must not be allowed to spread his poison."
"I assure you, we will find him," Commander Griot said fervently. "He has blighted all Sangheili. He has called us..."
Again, Griot hesitated.
"Cowards. The greatest insult known to our people. Unimaginable."
"It is he who is the coward," soothed McKen. "He has fled with his retinue, has left his homeworld and hidden himself away. There is nothing heroic about those deeds."
but privately McKen suspected that this was no act of cowardice. Usa Zelas was, as Griot had said, unusual. His motives were all but inscrutable. But cowardice? No. In all probability, the traitorous Sangheili had some grand scheme in mind. And at this moment, the prophet of inner conviction was inwardly convinced of only one thing, that when they all learned of the true purpose of this endgame, it would be a dreadful knowledge indeed. An uncharted forerunner shield world, 850 BCE, the Age of Reconciliation.
Great Usa Zelas, I do not challenge your leadership. The clans have accepted you. Who am I to challenge a Kaidan?
Usa said wryly, You are Krolan. You have always been Krolan, and you will be what you have always been. A pain in my side. Salas Krolan closed his jaws firmly, the Sangheili variant of a smile, but he didn't keep them shut for long. As the ancient saying goes, only a coward is always soothing. But great Usa, where are we now? We have come to a stranger place than all strange places. At least the caverns you led us into were on Sanghelios. But this is far from our world.
Ernica the Scarmaker shot a dark look of suspicion at Krolan.
Usa murmured aside to Ernica, Do not jump to conclusions about him. No need to mistake an annoying personality for a treasonous one.
Usa had seen many good warriors killed alongside the genuine traitors back on Sanghelios. The average Kaidan had a short way with those who were disloyal, typically by separating their heads from their necks. But sometimes there was more impulse than judgment in an execution. To slay a true enemy, now that was honorable. Technically, Krolan was a warrior, like all male Sangheili. To destroy a soldier out of pique was wasteful. So Usa remained calm and glanced around at their environment.
Yes, Krolan, it's true. This place is strange to the Sangheili. And yet I believe it was intended for us. Or for those who feel as we do.
They were deep underground, but not in a cavern. They were under the outer shell of the shield world his followers now called the Refuge. Nearby was the tomb of Kreka, a simple half-dome of metal, inscribed with the late warrior's name. The elder had passed on within a short period of arriving for the second and last time on the shield world. He had been walking in the natural garden of the eco-level, and had lain down, and simply not awakened. Usa intended a grander monument for the old Sangheili one day, for it was he who had made this refuge possible for Usa's adherents. But perhaps the entire shield world was truly his monument. The artificial world was sheathed in metal, like Kreka's tomb. Or rather, it was sheathed in what appeared to be a spherical, all-metal exterior. What it was truly composed of, what the Forerunners had forged, remained a mystery. Within the shell was a hollowed-out planetoid, the rocky surface life-seeded to create a tolerable habitation for occupation, complete with plant life, hills and valleys and streams, edifices of unknown purpose that could be used for habitation, and most important, a breathable atmosphere. Artificial sunlight beamed down from the concave shell that surrounded the world. In the distance, giant stalactite-like formations projected downward, like inversions of the towering city constructs of Sanghelios. Some of these structures seemed to be related to the shield world's power distribution. Below the inner crust of stone, soil, and water was another layer of artificial world, housing the inner workings of this ancient sanctuary. Atmosphere generation, power conduits, maintenance. Parts of it seemed unfinished, and indeed Usa was convinced that this shield world had not been completed by the Forerunners. He had a strong suspicion it was a new model, with new capabilities. and never quite tested. He intended to test those capabilities, if it was possible, when the time came. It would be dangerous. The results would either destroy all his people or save them. He reckoned the chances for either outcome were just about even. "Know that this world is a forerunner creation," Usa went on, "and thus it is sacred. But it was intended by the forerunners as a refuge, and we will use it exactly in that manner. We have enormous tasks to carry out. It will take a long time, many cycles, and it will demand tireless efforts from all of us. We will live here upon this surface, but most of the work will take place below, on the inner shells, in the artificial galleries below." "But, Great Usa," Krulon said, keeping his tone respectful and mild, but his words insistent, "we are woefully unprepared to function as part of this great machine you have brought us to. We do not know what we are doing here. These forerunner artifacts, much of the apparatus we see, it is a mystery to us. We have known forerunner works. We have discerned the function of some of them." Sangheili had taken up retro-engineering the forerunner technology in earnest in the latter part of the war with the Sanshayun. "But this?" "Your attitude, Krolon," Usa sharply replied, "is what kept us in the dark shadow of the Sanshayum to begin with. It was Sangheili like you who were reluctant to delve more deeply into the meaning of the forerunner devices. But we learned that what is sacred can be also useful, and perhaps even more sacred as a result. We nearly fought the Sanshayum to a standstill, using what we'd learned. If not for the cowardice of those who surrendered to the Covenant, but that is why we are here."
"Yes, Kaidan,"
Krolon said, almost whining, ducking his head in superficial submission.
"Your will is law.
Still, as this world's mechanisms are entirely new to us, there could be great danger in meddling with them. Dare we—"
"Krolon," Ernica growled. "Usa is one who sees the world from the sky."
Ernica was invoking an ancient Sangheili expression, referring to a being capable of mastering many arts, a person of genius and vision. "He studied this place with Suon Zaelis long before we came here. This is not his first visit. He knows all the apparatus well." That, of course, Usa reflected, was not really true. He understood some of the Forerunner's great creation, but there was a great deal more to learn, along with his loyal adherents. It could take an epoch to puzzle it all out, if ever. But he had also found the artificial intelligence enduring bias, which was able to explain what he needed to know most, once it had decided that explanations, at least some of them, somehow connected to its own purposes. Suln had a particular fascination with enduring bias, and engaged the flying voice, as some Sangheili called it, in long interrogatory conversations. Most of the Sangheili here respected Suln, but being female, she did not evoke full confidence. The Sangheili patriarchy was naturally unwilling to trust a female with the most critical leadership matters. But Suln had undeniable technical gifts, and Usa had learned to defer to her. Before Krolon could grumble about Suon not knowing her place, Usa spoke up, making his voice boom over the crowd. "Clansfolk, you have trusted me thus far. I have taken you from one world to another. You must trust me here. We have crossed the Great Torrent." The Great Torrent was a mythical, fiercely rushing river that once crossed could never be passed through again. "We cannot turn back. I believe we are safe here. The Covenant does not know of this world. It is an uncharted place, and they are not likely to find it. If they approach, we will have ample warning. We will survive. We have food, water, air, and most of all, hope. Rejoice with me in this, and remember that true Sangheili are always prepared for self-sacrifice. This is our keep now, our home. Yes, and it is Sangheili's, because wherever we go, there also is Sangheili's. And his followers raised their arms in the air, clacked their mandibles, and roared in response.
High Charity, 850 BCE, the Age of Reconciliation. I must tell you that High Charity now has a new ministry, McKen, Kurlom was saying, his voice low, and a new minister to go with it.
Not another one.
Oh, yes. And it's one to take special note of. They were descending on a purple-violet anti-gravity beam, their chairs side by side. In a short time, they'd reach the compartments of comfort, the residential facilities used by High Lord Prophets. Down they went, McKen gazing fixedly upward. Though McKen had long ago grown accustomed to the gravity lifts, he had always been a trifle uncomfortable with heights, and chose never to look down while using the device, since there was nothing under his feet but light and the long, long tube enclosing the lift area. A new ministry. McKen glanced at Kurlom. The elderly Sanshayum was hunched, gazing boldly down into the misty depths.
Ministries seem to proliferate, McKen said.
Certainly faster than Sanshayum. Soon there will be more ministries than there are members of our species.
You are pleased to be facetious, McKen. A bad habit of yours. But this is no matter for amusement. The Hierarchs have created the Ministry of Anticipatory Security. And the minister?
Is your old friend Erno. He made the gesture of irony to go with the word friend.
No, truly. They chose Erno Custo.
Yes, it is he. You two have been at odds many and many a time. I thought you probably had not been told yet, and you should be warned. They reached the residence level and drifted their chairs off the lift leading down a translucent passage to the transverse corridor. Impulsively, when they got to the place where they would part, McKen murmured,
Kurlom, thank you for letting me know.
About the ministry, I mean. Kurlom glanced around to see that they were alone, and tugged meditatively at one of his wattles.
I have myself been a hierarch, as you know. The reason I stepped down was not as much a question of my health as I'd let on.
Not health in that sense. McKen was surprised at this.
Then, what was it?
I felt something festering there, among the hierarchs. Some, I do not say who, are more concerned with their ambition than with the path to the great journey. You at least seem to have the inner conviction that led to your cognomen. I am happy to be able to give you a warning. But do not look for me to help with Erno. Just consider what this term, anticipatory security, might really mean. Kurlom gave the gesture of be well and be discreet, and turned his chair to float off toward his living quarters. McKen gazed after him, musing,
Yes, the phrase anticipatory security is quite unsettling.
The new ministry could be a danger to High Charity if it were working not for the benefit of all Sanshayum, but for one of the hierarchs. In all likelihood, the hierarch behind the new ministry was the simpering prophet of excellent redolence. He humbly preferred to be called merely excellent. He had chosen prophet of excellent redolence as his regnal title, but McKen had known him as Quid Clesto before his ascendance. Excellent was the master of subtle aggression, a great hinter of threats, of dire outcomes for those who crossed him. The threats, in good time, usually bore their poisonous fruit.
And yes, McKen had once crossed Excellent, had gone to the other two hierarchs to have him overruled in that regrettable matter of the plan to kidnap females from Jonjer Calm. Excellent had pretended to shrug the matter off, but he wasn't likely to forgive McKen. Not ever.
McKen turned away, eager to put those concerns behind him. He badly wanted to be alone with his spouse, the graceful Chrysanda. To feel her long neck twined around his, to savor her soft nuzzling of his wattles, her prehensile lips gently tugging at their fur. His desire for such intimacies seemed increased lately, and he wondered if there were certain, quite specific hormones involved. Could it be? McKen drifted to his residence's front door, sent the code from his chair to the door to unlock it, and passed into the understatedly incense-scented rooms. He felt a wave of relief when the door hissed shut behind him. Here, he could be himself. The San Shyum reformists, who'd stormed the dreadnought, occupying it in preparation for using it as a method of escape, had made secret forays to stock it with plants, wood, seeds, and other goods from Jonjer Calm. After the dreadnought took to the stars, an entire deck was adapted with special lights to grow stunted trees and plants for herbal teas and fresh food. The intricately carved screens that covered most of the walls in McKen's residence had been sculpted from wood grown on board. The stone fountain in one corner, tinkling softly to itself, was made of pieces of the rock drawn along behind the dreadnought when it had lifted off from the homeworld. The green-shaded lighting was an attempt to replicate the tint coming through high canopies of plants in the dense forests found in the lowlands of Jonjer Calm. Looking around with satisfaction, McKen eased out of his chair. He kept his relative physical firmness a secret from all San Shyum apart from Chrysanda. He didn't need the anti-grav chair, at least on high charity, as much as the others did. He had been careless about it several solar cycles ago with his steward, and it had been one of the sources of the fellow's resentment. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, the steward had been killed on the planet of Blue and Red. McKen often left his chair bobbing in the corner of his residence's front room. He enjoyed the use of his muscles. Chrysanda, too, moved about the apartment without her chair, and now she glided toward him, her sinuous neck moving with graceful pleasure on seeing her spouse.
"Beloved McKen, axis of my life, here you are already."
"We left our conferencing a bit early today, my dear. Kurlom was fatigued, and the others occupied." He added teasingly, "Am I intrusive? Should I go to the herbal steaming station and gossip with the attendants?"
"Don't you dare. You stay right here. I have a lovely herbal tea for you. Seat yourself."
"I prefer to stand for a time. I've been in that chair all day." She had come closer, and he could not keep from twining his neck with hers, nipping at the feminine hump on her back, just under her long neck.
"Oh, you scamper sneak," she chided, returning tease for teasing.
"There is something lately that has me yearn for you. Of course, I always feel that way. But lately, to be close to you is all I can think of."
"You? You're not one who thinks of such things at length. You're more likely pondering classic art, or planning the great doings of the species. You don't fool me a bit, McKen. Still, there might be a reason. Perhaps."
He drew back and, so breathless he could scarcely speak, looked into her large green-brown eyes.
"And that is?"
"Yes." Her eyes glittered with inner excitement.
"The time of reproductive yielding.
Truly.
Truly. It is upon me,
and as you and I are not on the roll of celibates, and as our people are in tragic need of offspring, of continuation, I suggest that when the mood strikes us this evening, we look to the possibility of generating a new San Shayum life. She looked away shyly. But perhaps that convergence is not of interest to you, and we can wait many cycles for another such opportunity. And perhaps I will quietly prepare your tea, your protein meshes, and we will speak of the progress of High Charity's construction, or perhaps a new color gloss on the throne of ease. Don't tantalize me. He twined Chrysanda again, his neck snaking half about hers. And don't mock me either. You know that I want nothing more than making a child with you. Still, she drew back and looked at him gravely. Still, what? There are considerations. He lowered his voice, though he regularly made sure that no surveillance mechanisms had been planted in his home. You know that there were issues with respect to my clearance from the role of celibates. And, Chrysanda signed, what of it? You took care of that long ago. Yes, I saw to it I was not disapproved. It would have been unfair. There were so few San Shayum, at least in space, and because there was a tendency to genetic blight among them, it was difficult to stay off the roll of celibates, the list designating those who were not approved for reproduction. But there were questions, and I was nearly on the roll. And Erno Custo is aware of this. And there is a new ministry. It seems as if there's always a new one. So I remarked to old Kerlom, but the latest edition is called the Ministry of Anticipatory Security, and Erno is now its appointed minister. Anticipatory security. What does it do? McKen snorted. I suspect it deals with security matters by anticipating them. That way, Erno, and perhaps his sponsor, Excellent Redolence, can condemn whoever they like. Because they anticipate that person will be a danger to High Charity. What? Such a ministry could not long remain. It's madly unjust. People won't stand for it. I suspect you're right. In time it will be undone. But in the meantime, we could run a risk by openly reproducing. Erno is not friendly to me. If he finds out about a pregnancy, and he inevitably will, it could lead to some dark treachery on his part, used against both of us. Chrysanda looked at the floor. I see. Then we will speak only of construction and color glosses, and nothing more. He clasped her hands in his. Chrysanda. Please do not mistake me. I could not keep from you. But I just wanted you to know that there is risk. I wanted to be fair to you, and... She put a hand on his lips. McKen, it's always a risk to start a family. Everything joyous is a risk. Only in fear is complete safety, and then one lives in its jaws forevermore. You and I will not live that way. And then she came closer and entwined with Chrysanda. McKen felt he had truly come home.